In this episode, guest John Mollison tells us how he uses the process of capturing an exact, historically accurate rendering of a particular combat aircraft to learn more about the human side of history. In the news, we talk about the FAA reauthorization bill, is United Airlines getting better, spraying airplanes to fight the Zika virus, the A-10 gets a reprieve, and Icelandair steps up their game with a stopover buddy. All that coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 388 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is our high-mileage co-host and associate producer, Brian Coleman. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Max. It's so great to be here 2 weeks in a row. Yay for me. Been doing a little bit of traveling this year and looking forward to a great show tonight.
Fantastic. Hopefully the technology is going to work. We've been having some problems with Skype, but we'll see what we can do. We've also got with us Max Trescott. He's a CFI, an author, and a glass cockpit expert. Hey, Max.
Hey, hello, Max, fellow co-host and listeners around the world. And I just want to chime in that I'm kind of a low-mileage co-host because these days I try and avoid airline travel whenever possible.
Right, as do many of us. Also with us is Rob Mark. He's also a pilot, a flight instructor, an aviation journalist, and publisher of the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Being from beautiful, frosty Chicago.
Frosty. It's that time of year. We're kind of spread across the country. We've got East Coast, West Coast, in the middle. Also kind of in the Midwest is our guest this episode. He's John Mollison. John is an artist, a writer, and a filmmaker. Now, John's interviewed well over 100 highly decorated airmen since 1999, including people like Medal of Honor recipients Joe Foss and Leo Thorsness, also presidential candidate and Senator George McGovern, people like best-selling author Robert Mason, and Morris Jepson, the bomb electronics officer aboard the Enola Gay. Now, in his own words, John says he, quote, interviews old guys and draws their airplanes. He uses this process of capturing an exact, historically accurate rendering of a particular combat aircraft to learn more about the human side of history. John interviews pilots and air crew of a particular aircraft in order to learn things like what makes people go to war, what makes people cope with stress, how do people define success, and really, most importantly, I think, what can be passed on to future generations so they can avoid the mistakes of the past. John, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thank you.
It's a real pleasure to have you here. I know our other co-host, David Vanderhoof, is not able to join us this episode. He's very disappointed. I think that we were going to maybe try to get a little pitting of the aviation historian minds together here, but I think you're off the hook.
Thank goodness. I don't like to be challenged.
All right. Well, we're going to speak with John about some of the interesting people that he's been interviewing and the production that he puts together. Really fantastic interviews, very valuable to watch. But before we do that, let's get started with the aviation news. So is everyone ready?
Ready.
Yeah. Ready from the West.
Our first item, this comes from AOPA, details of long-awaited FAA reauthorization bill revealed. Now, funding under the FAA Modernization and Reform Act of 2012 expires on March 31st of this year, 2016. And on February 3rd, Representative Bill Shuster from Pennsylvania, who's chairman of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, he announced Bill H.R. 4441. This is called the Aviation Innovation Reform and Reauthorization Act of 2016. And if you take the leading letters from that, that spells the AIR Act, A-I-I-R. One of the things that politicians, I think, maybe are most successful at these days is coming up with acronyms for their bills. This bill addresses some unmanned aircraft issues, which David and I cover in the UAV Digest, episode 132. So we'll sort of leave that portion of it out. If you're interested in that, you can visit the UAVDigest.com. But otherwise, this AIR Act offers up some things that we've been talking about, some things we've been concerned about. Rob, you want to sort of start us off with some impressions from what this bill looks like?
Good. I hope you. I thought you were going to ask me for some impressions of somebody else, but but kind of like we talked about last week when I did that editorial about this. It's run by the airlines, and so long as you understand that, and that the airlines are pretty much going to control this board that they want to put together, it's going to change the way that air transportation is moved around the country forever. And the only thing that I didn't predict, which kind of caught me napping, was that the controllers union signed on to this, which means they must have offered them something. And this is kind of like what, you know, Delta did before they, you know, did the merger. They made sure all the unions were in line before they even announced the whole thing. And so my guess is that this has been the same way, because the air traffic controllers union was not in favor of this to start with. So like I said, they must have offered them some kind of incredible longevity guarantees and the same pay and who knows what else to get them to sign on. But this is going to be a tough one to beat, because there's I read something from one of the guys, Dan Reed, on Forbes.com a couple of days ago, and he said he's been impressed with how little opposition there seems to be to this bill. And that means that business and GA apparently are not doing their part to get out there and rattle Congress's cage to say, hey, this is not a good idea. So I don't know. I don't think it bodes well for us.
No, yeah, Rob, or is that because it's 270 pages and no one struggled to read through the 270 of them?
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. I did worry about that last week, because I said if it's a good bill and it really improves things, fine, I'll go along with it. I just don't want Congress to vote on that damn thing the way they did the Obamacare bill, when everybody said later, well, actually, you know, I never even read the thing. I'm sorry, that's just unconscionable to me. So, but I got through 12 pages of it so far.
Well, what I really dislike about how this is done is that this is kind of one of these all things plus the kitchen sink thrown in together. So, you know, the problem we have is they start off with the authorization. So as I understand, you know, Congress has to authorize, you know, an agency's budget for so many years. And then later on, they give an appropriation, you know, for each of those years. So this is kind of the, you know, the high 50,000, you know, foot view. And I think there's going to be pressure to sign it, just simply because it reauthorizes the FAA for a number of years. But then the problem is they add, you know, literally 200 sections, you know, to the bill, with everything imaginable thrown in. So I think it's going to be very difficult to, you know, to take just part of the bill. And they've sold it in a way that I think is going to be to minimize the opposition by GA, and that is they. Buried deep down in it, they say that the user fees that they will implement will not apply to piston aircraft. So suddenly, the owners of 200,000 aircraft are, you know, not going to be too upset because these user fees will not apply to them. Well, I am absolutely certain that their time is going to come, you know, whether it be 5 or 10 years down the road or 2 years down the road, when the you know, funding is not sufficient to sustain this this organization. They're going to go back to Congress and go, well, now we need to charge the piston guys. And at that point, it's going to be too late. So I really think this is the camel with its nose under the tent. You know, we've seen every country that's privatized ATC and gone to user fees has absolutely destroyed their general aviation. And so I'm very concerned about this.
Hmm. Now, this does include third-class medical reform, doesn't it?
I think that's the kitchen sink part that Max is talking about, because there's something in it for everybody to love. And so how do you say, well, you know, I really want that third-class medical reform, or I really want to see that that treatment of drones, or I really want to see the controllers keep their jobs, or and if you throw something for everybody in there, it's, as I said last week, I think it's going to be almost impossible to beat this down. And I think that's what they're hoping for, not to mention that there are primaries coming up very soon, which people are focused on.
And I kind of wonder, I had a conversation today with somebody at the FAA regarding the near midair collision that I reported from 3 or 4 weeks ago. And I thought about it afterwards, and I thought, wow, you know, here we have a part of the FAA, which the FAA's primary mission is safety. And they're very good about going back and, you know, investigating to figure out, well, did a near miss, you know, really happen to Max? And, you know, what could be done in the future to try and avoid those kinds of things? Yeah, I just worry if suddenly we've now broken ATC apart from the rest of the FAA. You know, how does that whole oversight process occur? Because right now, the Quality Department of Air Traffic Control is doing the initial investigation, and then it's going to be passed over to the FAA's FISDO for the kind of the final investigation. Well, now those are two separate organizations, and so what? ATC is going to investigate themselves, and that's the end of it? I worry that we're going to lose the focus on safety that we've had with the current structure. So I'm not real happy with the idea of breaking ATC out of the FAA.
You know, I was looking at the press release that Schuster put out. It's interesting, you know, going back to what Rob was saying, I think, about controllers buying off on this. In his press release, Schuster says the comprehensive reauthorization bill, which removes over 30,000 people from the government's from the federal government's payroll, wow, also streamlines FAA's aviation equipment and aircraft certification process, provides additional consumer protections, addresses aviation safety issues, gives the FAA more tools for the safe integration of unmanned aircraft systems, and provides for airport infrastructure improvements across the country. So, yeah, I mean, it does include a lot of stuff, but 30,000 people, those are the controllers, right?
Well, 14,000 or so are probably controllers, and the rest are probably airway systems people and, you know, that maintain the equipment and got to be headquarters people in there, too. I just don't know
management.
How many. Sure. Yeah, exactly. That's the headquarters. I'm sorry, headquarters and regional office people.
Yeah, and I just can't see those jobs being contracted out and being more efficiently done for less money. So ultimately, I just see this as costing the taxpayers more money in the long run.
So you're saying you think that the federal government is more efficient than private industry?
In things like this, yeah. I think that this will be an opportunity for the private entity that ends up running it to charge the government more than what the government would have charged had all these people remained federal employees. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's okay. That's an interesting point. Yeah. It is. How does the charging mechanism, the pricing mechanism for this work, and how is that controlled? I mean, that raises a whole nother layer of bureaucracy in terms of, you know, I mean, we see that with military procurement, certainly, where, you know, the costs, the procurement management costs are not insignificant.
Well, and let's not forget, too, the main issue here is that this air bill created by Schuster and his gang was not created with all of the parties involved, because business aviation and general aviation were not at the table.
Yeah.
So if you really wanted to sell this, then what they should have had was AOPA and EAA and NBAA there, and then at least everybody would know what was going on. But that's not the way they did it. So, you know, how everybody in the industry can say, oh, well, I guess it's going to be pretty good, knowing that the people that represent the majority of the pilots and the airplane owners in the U.S. were not even invited, that's a really dumb idea, and that's why I hope people will go to, let me plug it, nbaa.org/advocacy. Contact Congress.
All right. Well, speaking about things getting better, we see Forbes says that there are five signs that United Airlines is finally getting better.
Huh.
Brian, this must have come from you.
Sorry. Yeah, I did find this, and I just found it absolutely hysterical. And I really hope that it is true, but I just didn't believe it. And I like the one line in here where the writer said, "The last truly exceptional CEO at United was Stephen Wolfe. He left in 1994, forced out by pilots." And I just can't think of really anything great that he did for the airline except bring on the 777 and the design of the overhead bins. If I recall correctly, he was like 6'4". So being able to stand without the overhead bin whacking him in the head was a really big, novel, fantastic improvement with a 777. And, you know, he certainly brought United along as a launch customer of that. But everyone else is, I don't know, including him, in my opinion, have just been a disaster for United.
Let's not forget the title. United is getting better. And the unwritten part is better than what? They sucked before. I mean, so anything they do to improve probably is an improvement.
Yeah, well, one of the other headlines, I believe, was United's quest to be less awful. You know, that kind of ties right in there, right? Doesn't it?
Well, there are a few things in here that, I think are interesting, maybe worth noting. The Forbes says that the CEO, Oscar Munoz, has got kind of a different tenor to his approach, that he's much more upbeat and enthusiastic, at least in the earnings call. They saw that as a positive sign. They also said that in this pilot ratification of the 2-year contract extension, 79% of the United pilots ratified it. That's kind of a high percentage to vote for the contract. That's indicates maybe that, you know, things are good on the labor relations front. And there's a couple other items in here as well. They're all kind of indirect, and it doesn't have quite the punch to it that it would if there's five signs that, you know, United is providing better customer support or flyer satisfaction or that sort of a thing.
Right. And they say, so the fourth item on the list there was that United's building out its San Francisco hub as its primary gateway to Asia, which is great for San Francisco. But me being in Los Angeles, it certainly stinks. Because they've cut a whole bunch of flights, and in the process, they've managed to really tick off the flight attendants, because the legacy United flight attendants, you know, they're still working under a separate labor agreement than the Continental flight attendants. All of these new flights are all going to Continental flight attendants. So they're changing the hub structure. They're putting favoritism towards Continental flight attendants. And from my perspective, it's wreaking havoc. And, you know, the guidance that United put forth is for the first quarter, their passenger unit revenue is set to decline 6-8%. They're saying that the decline's due to a strong US dollar, lower surcharges, which I certainly haven't seen lower surcharges. I haven't seen lower fares either. They're saying it's reduced travel because of employees that work for oil-based companies. You know, so a lot of people in Texas and Norway not traveling back and forth to each other. And the softening of domestic and international yields. Well, if you'd improve the product, I think you'd have people flying your airline. So again, I was just dumbfounded by this article.
Okay. Well, we'll be watching. I think the market will be watching to see if, in fact, you know, United generates more positive feedback from their customers, as well as from the shareholders and so forth and employees. You know, you need to please all three of those groups if you really want to have a successful airline, I think.
And again, I've said it before, I really wish the best for Oscar. I hope his heart transplant goes well and he continues to recover and gets back to work soon.
Yes. Let's move on to another item. This is from CNN. A UK asks airlines to spray insecticide to fight Zika virus. The British government, they've made a request. They would like all airlines that are flying from areas that are subject to or affected by the Zika virus to spray their planes with insecticide before coming back to the UK. You know, this is one of those things that could really impact aviation if it turns out to be perceived as, you know, a huge health problem. You know, sometimes we talk about the growth in airline traffic and, you know, all the airplanes being purchased and the new pilots we need and so forth. But, you know, we tend to not imagine the things that can happen that can really kind of dash those plans. I don't know. Do you guys think that this is one of those things that could turn out to be something very serious for the industry?
I was reading about Zika over the weekend because I hadn't really spent any time looking at it at all other than to see headlines and go, oh, yeah, it doesn't affect me. And I was really quite surprised to see that the reporting that it's throughout all of the Americas up to about the Texas border, which means, wow, you know, if you're anywhere south of Texas, you're in a country that has some Zika issues. It's mosquito-borne. It's the first mosquito-borne disease or virus that has actually resulted in deformities. And so for pregnant women, it's particularly dangerous. What they've seen is that babies are born with their foreheads much, much smaller than normal. So they've got a very tiny top of their head, basically. And so they don't really know the long-term issues, but clearly that's a problem right there. They started spotting this in Brazil, I guess, over the last year or so, and finally put it all together as to what was going on. So I think the issue for all of us is that if you're traveling to a country in South America or Central America, or if you're in contact with someone who's just come back from there, you sure as heck better not be pregnant because it could have a serious impact on your unborn child.
Yeah, Max, there are two things that really confuse me about spraying the aircraft. And one, it reminds me of the days when Australia really, when they really wanted to isolate themselves and protect their island continent, and they would spray all incoming aircraft with insecticide and might have been effective for killing any bugs, parasites that were on the plane, in addition to the passengers, but it didn't do anything for people that might have been affected or infected, where with the Zika virus, if you're already infected, spraying the plane isn't going to do any good.
You're absolutely right, because the symptoms don't show up immediately. So you're right. People will come back into the country. And once again, this is something that may look good and sound good, but it's not addressing a large part of the problem.
Yeah, and I had been on several planes to Australia where they, you land, they open the doors really quick, a whole bunch of ground personnel get on board, and they walk up and down the aisle with these cans of insecticide or whatever it was and spray the plane, and then they, you sit there for another 15 minutes, and then you get to deboard while you're breathing in all this crap. And I don't know. I just don't see this as a good solution to the Zika virus issue.
Well, there is one good piece of news, which is that it appears that new cases of Zika in Brazil have peaked already. So it looks like it's following the classic epidemic curve and has started to head down. Now, I don't know that that's true for all countries, but that was kind of the origin of most of the cases. So we could be headed in the right direction here.
Hmm. Yeah, that would certainly be good. All right, let's move on to our next item, the A-10. Now,
where's David when we need him?
I was really hoping, David's probably glad he's not here. I was really hoping we would not continue on with the A-10 conversation because we really hear from a lot of folks, which is great, but the passions are very high. And we see here in aeronews.net that the Defense Secretary, Ash Carter, he said that the DOD is, quote, investing to maintain more of our fourth-generation fighter and attack jets than we previously planned, including the A-10, which has been devastating ISIL from the air. He says the budget defers the A-10's final retirement until 2022. There's the good news. Here's some news that people, maybe not everybody, will think is good news. Replacing it with F-35s on a squadron-by-squadron basis, so we'll always have enough aircraft for today's conflicts. But at least for now, the A-10 continues. John, have you along the way interviewed any folks that are either flew or benefited from the support provided by A10s?
No, those guys are a little young for me.
Okay, so they're not the old enough guys yet.
Old guys.
They got to be slow enough for you to catch them. Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's it. I love it. No A10 pilots yet.
Okay. The A-10 is still being funded, at least for the near term until 2022, and a lot of people will be very, very happy with that.
Yay!
Yeah.
Though David might not be. He argued rather strongly that it was perhaps not the best use of money, that they were expensive to maintain and that they were, you know, disappearing and so on and so forth. I was actually arguing the other side, but I know a lot less about this than David, so right, I'll leave it at that.
Hey, one last news story. This comes from TravelPulse.com, and the title is great. Want to go skiing with Iceland Air's CEO. We've spoken with the head of WOW Air, another Iceland airline that competes with Iceland Air for low fares between the U.S. and Europe, using Iceland as a waypoint. But Max T, this is kind of another approach here. Iceland Air seems to be stepping up the game.
I just thought this was hilarious when I saw it. I thought, wow, now this is novel. I have never seen this kind of perk for the airlines before. Essentially what Iceland Air is saying, if you want to fly to Europe and you'd like to stop over in Iceland for a day or two, we, Iceland Air, will match you up with one of our employees to show you around Iceland or to have fun, and that you might actually be able to go skiing with the CEO of Iceland Air. And I just thought, wow, that's a rather novel approach.
Yeah, do you get to pick your employee that you get to hang out with, or do they assign them?
Yeah, that would be fun, wouldn't it?
Yeah, this program is called the Iceland Air Stopover Buddy. And we'll put a link to the webpage in the show notes. As a passenger, you can request a stopover buddy. It's free. There's no charge for it. And yeah, as you say, an employee who could even be the CEO, spend some time showing you the sights of Iceland. I just think it's a really clever idea, and we'll have to see how our friends at WOW Air maybe come back with something to try to see if they can top that.
I'm well, with Brian, though. I think we need to make sure that they give you a choice of friends to hang out with.
I saw something in the news just today that said that Icelandic was offering $600 round trips to cities in Europe from select cities here in the United States. So I was surprised that was a round trip fare, but of course none of those were from San Francisco or LA, so had to be in an East Coast city to benefit.
All right. Again, we're speaking with our guest, John Mollison. So old guys in their airplanes, what was the genesis of this idea? What compelled you to track down old aviators and folks involved in aviation and capture their stories?
Well, there's two parts of this. I host a show called Old Guys in Their Airplanes, and that's a video interview of some of the aviation notables that I've been able to meet over the years. But this really started when I was a little boy, probably, I guess, age 3, when my mom, to keep me occupied, would go get my dad's model airplane boxes and put them in front of me. And if you remember those model airplane boxes from the 70s, they had some pretty spectacular artwork. Mm. And she would tell me to draw the next scene and then explain to her what happened. So what I would do is I would look at these really cool boxes. And, then I remember one box, it was a Ravel kit of a Ki-84 as a Japanese fighter plane shooting down some B-29s. And I remember describing to her the story. But while I'm describing to her the story of what happened next, which, of course, the Japanese airplane gets shot to bits, I'm getting in the back of my head this lore of the people who took part in that history. So fast forward up until I was a corporate flacky, I was in the corporate machine, and I ended up Peter principling to the point where I had enough employees and enough responsibility that I didn't know what the heck I was doing. And I had just happened to bump into Bud Anderson, who was a World War II fighter pilot, triple ace test pilot. And I just happened to talk to Bud. I was in a weird moment, and I just said, "Bud, look, tell me how you handled leading people into combat when you were 22, because I've got to lead this group of people into business, and I'm, you know, 35. And the conversation that happened from that was really incredible. I was blown away by the person I was talking to. I realized this guy knew what he was talking about. And so I offered Bud, I said, "Look, I'll draw your airplane." And I hadn't stopped drawing airplanes. And so I was, you know, in the advertising business. So I took my artwork and I had it professionally reproduced. I mailed Bud 5 prints of my artwork. I got a little letter back. Bud said, "You know, you have 4. I liked what you did. I kept one." I was so thrilled. And it was like my time. So I'm doing something of value. And in the conversation that transpired after that with Bud, he said that if I continued to keep asking questions of him and his generation, he would give me all the highly ranked, prestigious figures from aviation history and World War II. And that really got it started. So I started drawing these pilots. They all started around Bud's friends, and then it branched off. I would draw their airplanes, pay to get it printed, and then the pilot would have some prints of their airplane, and I'd have an interview. And the interviews just didn't stop. They weren't like once. I ended up, you know, staying at their houses, and then becoming personal friends and getting Christmas gifts, and it turned into this thing that was really big. So when I created Old Guys in Their Airplanes, this is after I had my website up and after my blog, you know, people had asked me enough time, "You really should take your interviews and put them to video." So Old Guys in Their Airplanes, the show, is the video portion of what I'd been doing, and which all came from my mom inspiring me to draw airplanes.
How interesting. Yeah. The videos are incredibly well produced, and it's just very high quality, at least the ones that I've watched. Congratulations on those, John. Just to dwell for just a little bit on the artwork, because this is really, really amazing stuff. Very, you know, realistic and accurate. So, John, when you're approaching, you know, the task of capturing an airplane, drawing it, what goes through your mind? What are the elements that helps you sort of capture the essence of the airplane, sort of the soul of the airplane? How do you go about taking something then and reproducing it on a piece of paper or whatever that just, you know, brings it alive?
Well, drawing an airplane is easy. In 10 minutes, I could teach you how to draw any airplane. It's a physical shape. It's very well defined. I mean, you can plot this out with a ruler and a pencil and any reference book. You know, a plane is 36 feet, whatever. It's that part isn't hard, and it's in some ways it's not really inspiring. To me, the thing that inspires me is the story. And when I'm drawing an airplane and I know it's going to go to a 95-year-old guy in California, and he's never had anybody draw his airplane, his family is maybe disinterested or has never been told the story, I'm drawing that airplane and making those prints for somebody's great-great-grandchildren. That inspires me. So the airplane, I'd love to tell you I'm slaving over the artwork. And I do slave over it, but it's not – I'm not there trying to make the most realistic, rivet-counted, perfect airplane. What I'm there is I know I'm creating something – that somebody's relative is going to look at and go, "Wow, that's cool." And God only knows what's going to go through their head. So I tease people that my artwork will never show up on a garage sale. Remember, most of my, almost all my prints are signed by the pilot who flew it. Then it becomes special. Anybody can draw airplanes. But when I think about Bud Anderson or Dick Rutan, or, you know, I'm looking around my studio right now at some of the, you know, I got my own artwork on the wall. You know, I think Mac McWhorter, Punchy Powell, Bill Creech, I could go on. Those guys make it human. And it inspires you to go, okay, the guy who flew that in combat, that's an average person. That's just a normal person. What's that about? So that's the thing that inspires me. I finished an F4F, a little Wildcat that was flown off Guadalcanal. Just finished it. I've been talking to the pilot. His name is Sam Folsom. And he painted the nose art of his Wildcat. And so here I am recreating his artwork. That is, to me, a tremendous honor. And it's just the neatest thing to think, okay, now I'm part of their family. I'm part of their story. And this guy is an artist just like anybody else. And it's just cool. So it's kind of a hallowed mission, so to speak. I don't know if that made any sense to you, but it drives
me. Yeah, no, it does. It makes quite a bit of sense. And also, I'm wondering if the intent of the, you know, old guys in their airplane show, is it the same, or is it really out to accomplish something a little different?
Well, I would say it takes it to a deeper level. Yeah. I'll say this. You know, I'm a child of the 70s. I grew up a latchkey kid with a lot of privilege, and then I get out there in the world, and I had a lot of opportunities, and a lot of things break my way. But my generation, what we've seen is we're disconnected with our grandparents, our fathers in many ways, our mothers in many ways. When I produce the show, I try to make the connection of the human side and what can we learn from these people? What can we know about them as, you know, as somebody's dad, somebody's grandfather, somebody's uncle, somebody's cousin, somebody's lived down the street? There's got to be something more to their life than there I was at 30,000 feet surrounded by Germans, you know? So that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, John, one of the things that we talked about in the pre-show, and I can't remember your exact quote, but you're talking about capturing history and being able to do it now for when these people pass, the history is going to be gone, right? Or at least the oral story is going to be gone. Do you recall your soundbite of what that was? And can you talk a little bit about that?
Capturing the story and the history, a lot of people do this. You have to understand, museums all across the country are doing oral histories. Families are hiring videographers to do, you know, let's get grandpa's story down. The thing is, though, is that these stories need to be made public. It's one thing to keep them in the family. It's another thing to keep them in your museum on a monitor that's running 24/7 that may only reach 10,000 people. What I want to do is I want to take these stories and these examples of real character, real human experience, and get them to millions. And so that's important to me. These stories, they're the human experience, and they're absolutely crucial. That's how we learn from one another, generation to generation. Our country, the United States, if we do so many wonderful things, but that's one thing I wish we did better at. And so that's what I'm trying to do.
John, maybe you can give our listeners an example of one of the stories, something that had maybe a lot of meaning to you, but would also help them kind of understand the depth of what it is that you're capturing.
Yeah, you had to hit me with that.
I'm sorry.
You know, I honest to goodness, if you... To say there's a one story, when I think about, you know, the experiences I've had with these guys, again, most of them are not just a single phone call or a, you know, meeting in a hotel lobby. You know, I would say that a story that comes to mind, it's certainly not the greatest or most impactful, but it's important to me, is a story that we did. We just finished the show. The show is called Wind Beneath Your Wings. It's an old guys in their airplane story, but it's a story of an ex-POW by the name of Chris Morgan. Chris Morgan was a prisoner of the Japanese. And if you know anything about being a prisoner of the Japanese in World War II, I believe the fatality rate for an Allied flyer under the Germans, and I'm aware of all the atrocities the Germans did, but if you're an Allied flyer in the prison system, I think your fatality rate was something like 3%. But if you were a prisoner of the Japanese, depending upon your source, it's between 33 and 46%. So what these guys went through was an additional level of horror. Well, at any rate, Chris Morgan's story. He came back from World War II. He had significant PTSD. He developed an alcohol problem. He had a tough time melding into society. He told me a story where he was on a war bond rally, and he shared the experiences that led him up to be a POW. Just sidebar, he was on his very first combat mission, flight of four. The flight leader got him lost. They ran out of gas over Burma. They bellied in, were captured by the Japanese. Chris, after being repatriated on a warbound rally, tells the story to a group of, you know, one of those little, you know, civilian things, and they started laughing at his story. And this harkens back to something that was kind of in the news this past summer when Donald Trump said, you know, POWs aren't heroes because they got captured. Well, I had a significant relationship with Chris Morgan at the time, as well as, you know, getting to know some Vietnam War POWs. And so I heard this story and I thought to myself, you know, what there are things about Donald Trump there. He's made some things that make sense. But when he told me that the POWs, you know, weren't his heroes because he got captured, and I'm thinking in the back of my head, buddy, you don't know what that's like. You have no idea the pain of these people, what they've come back from combat and had random things happen to them. And suddenly I understood the PTSD situation. I understood people have trauma, and I have plenty of stories of the combat action. And like I've said, there I was at 30,000 feet surrounded by the enemy. But the stories I'm looking for are the stories of humanity. Like hearing Bud Anderson burst into tears. I mean, just he and I, when he's talking about his crew chief, Otto Heinemann, I think it was his name or something like that, how he scrubbed the camouflage off of his airplane with avgas and steel wool. And years later, that act still made Bud cry. You start seeing these people as real, and your sense of what a hero is, your sense of what a man is, your sense of what somebody who thrives in the face of danger changes. So the stories that I get, just kind of give you one anecdotally during an interview, it's tough. I need to prepare. That's why I put them in video. That's why I write. When I write on my blog, you know, I'm taking just a layer of what I actually have, and it's still not enough.
Are you seeing a lot of interest in stories pertaining to the Vietnam War?
Here's something. I got to tell you this. I never had any interest in anything with the Vietnam War. I mean, like I said, I grew up in the 70s. Everything the Vietnam War was bad. You didn't talk about it. World War II was good. And I got contacted by a Vietnam War F-4 squadron, the 334th Fighting Eagles, the greatest squadron in the Vietnam War. By the way, that's a plug to them. But I got contacted by them to draw their airplane, and they invited me to come to their reunion and go drinking with them and talk to them and all that good stuff. And it just so happened that after that, I learned to see the Vietnam War in a new way. I saw their brotherhood, the way they interacted with each other, the way they regarded their service, their authenticity in how they could recall the frustrations of the Vietnam War, but at the same time, maintain this incredible level of duty, honor, and country, and brotherhood to each other. I came back, and it not only inspired me to go to Vietnam, but it inspired me to start drawing Vietnamese airplanes, putting them on my blog, and then I started to get hate mail. Huh. And I thought to myself, what the heck? I'm just drawing airplanes and telling stories.
Yeah.
And then I knew I hit a nerve because I can write anything I want about World War II. Shoot, I mean, if I go to my blog, the most viewed airplane I have is a Luftwaffe airplane I drew. I never even got to interview the pilot. And so anything with World War II is just popular. But boy, I hit on Vietnam, and I would actually get people emailing, what's my business looking into the Vietnam War? And they were there, and it was a terrible point, and we should never bring it up, and blah, blah, blah. But bottom line, if I can look at my search engine queries and my stats, more and more, I'm getting people to my website when they are typing in things like F4 or North Vietnamese MiG-17 or something to that effect. People out there around the world are really interested in the Vietnam War. And it's personally, it's difficult for me. I wish I could write about the good war, as Stutz Terkel wrote. Vietnam War is difficult. It doesn't give me a whole lot of pleasure, but boy, I tell you what, the stories are ripe, and people seem to want to know, and I have a chance to get in there and uncover a few stories. So I try to respond.
Yeah, I can kind of see that also as being a product of the 70s. Those were difficult times with the Vietnam War, and I can imagine that, you know, a lot of us who participated in either the war itself or protesting it or whatever, there's probably a lot of interest in it, kind of having the perspective of time. You know, we know how it felt at the time, but now that we're older, now that we're wiser, now that we've had all these other life experiences, I think it's kind of appealing to want to take a look at it again and understand it from a different perspective. I thought the recent episode, or the latest episode, I think episode 7, There and Back, was really fascinating. That was Captain Charlie Plum, was it? He was a POW who went back to Vietnam.
Yeah, he... That's actually our second to last episode. Chris Morgan's is the last episode.
Okay.
But yeah, we took Charlie back to North Vietnam, and we had a little tour from Hanoi to Haiphong all the way down to Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, and then ended up near the Cambodian border on a river with the ranking North Vietnamese MiG-17 ace, Win Vom Bay. Drinking his homemade booze. It was weird, you know. I don't know, but it's I think you said it well. I think people now have grown up and they've matured and they've put aside the emotion, and now they just want to go back and experience it, just to be objective. And for me, I'm learning. You know, I was in diapers during the last of the Vietnam War, so I'm just kind of a spectator and trying to catch it all in for my new audience. That's yeah.
So I got to believe that you're really having a blast doing this.
It's the Vietnam War isn't a blast when you write about it and you learn about it. It's challenging and it's hard because you can't get away from this idea of this wasn't a war we needed to fight. And when you're reading about people, I'm talking to another POW. I'm drawing his F-105, and you can't get away from the idea of this guy was in a prison camp for 6 years for what? You can't leave that aside. Whereas when I write about, you know, World War II, I mean, you know, the Japs were bad and the Germans were bad and we won and it was great and it was worth the struggle. But you go back over there and you meet them. They're regular people. You're always presented with this idea of, was this the right thing to do? Were our leaders making good decisions? the good thing about the Vietnam War, for me at least, is it's given me an incredible valuation of the political process. The people we elect matter. The people are elected officials hire to bring in to be advisors matter. I'm not cynical about the process anymore. I care very deeply about who I'm going to vote for, who I'm going to support. And I realize my little voice, it matters. And so a good thing that's come out, that's been for me for the Vietnam War. Somebody else might disagree with that, but it's been inspiring to me in that regard.
Fascinating perspective. I like this.
It's an interesting thing you mentioned about the war. And I mean, I was in the Air Force in the Vietnam era. And what was really interesting to me is that, you know, being overseas, hearing the radio commentary about what was going on back home and occasionally seeing TV clips and whatever. But when he came home, and I think I got out of the Air Force in 71, and people would say, oh, well, I haven't met you. What have you been doing? And he'd say, well, I was in the Air Force. And they'd go, oh, that's nice. Hmm. And they would just kind of walk away from you. And I thought, whoa, you know, that was – I'd heard about that kind of thing, but it the distaste didn't come across the same way in the news media as it did for people that were in the military at that point in time. But, you know, you mentioned that was a war we didn't need to fight. I mean, let's be serious. Which ones – in the last decade, have we really needed to fight? Did we really need to go into Iraq? And when we pulled out, what did we leave? The whole Middle East has been changed. Did we do any good or did we make it worse?
Right.
You could go on and on with that kind of stuff.
Wait, I have a comment to make on this. Okay, this is a true story because it happened to my kid. My son took AP Advanced History, and because, you know, he's my son, he gets to put up with all my history stuff. And he was really looking forward to finally getting to learn about the Vietnam War. And he would tell me, you know, Dad, next month, next week. And then I remember him getting a text, Dad, today we start our Vietnam War unit. And at noon, I got another text from him, Dad, we're done with our Vietnam War unit. And I had to ask, I said, so how many minutes did you get? And he said, I figure 22. Now, here's the thing. This is AP history. And now I am faulting the history teachers and the educational process. But let's just say for some unknown reason, my son ends up in Congress or in some sort of position of authority. I want him to know everything there was about that war. I want him to know why it happened, how it happened, its effects for the Vietnamese, for the world, for the United States, for the servicemen, for the branches, for technology. And he got 22 minutes on a war that arguably changed America almost as much as World War II did. Mm. Now you think about that. That's, to me, is tragic. Mm. That's why I do what I do. It was in keeping these stories alive, at least, you know, in technology and what you guys are doing with your podcast, being able to broadcast for the whole world. We're living in great days. We're living in great days to be history buffs. And I think that we're actually on the beginning, the left hand of the bell curve of a rise in appreciating history for what it is.
Wow.
If that's only true.
I'm going to say the same thing. That would just be so enormous.
Yeah, well, enormous, but I think it's necessary. And this is, if you think about it, we all learn from somebody else who's been there. And when we go into the work world or whatever we do, you know, hopefully we've got great relationships with our parents or grandparents to teach us how to be parents, how to be citizens, how to be good leaders, good millwrights, good doctors, good lawyers, good aviation artists. We need to be connected to this idea of legacy. If you go to my website, and this is a shameless plug, but it's germane. There's a quote that I have on there that I got from Richard Hilton. He was a F-4 pilot in the Vietnam War. And he doesn't claim credit for it, but he gave it to me. And that's, when an old man dies, a library burns. Hmm. Now you think about that.
Yeah.
When an old, and that happens to old ladies too, by the way. And I think about the Vietnam War. This is one more chance for us to get some of these old guys, these old men, to talk, to share their stories on a deep level and learn from them so that the future generations, me, my kids, their kids, you got to believe we can learn from the past. You got to, or else why be alive?
John, you've very graciously offered to allow us to provide a print, one of your prints, to one of our listeners. Tell us about that print and how it came about.
This is one of the coolest prints I ever did. It's a print that has four airplanes, World War II airplanes. One is the B-25 flown by Dick Cole and Doolittle on the Doolittle raid. I've also got Bud Anderson's P-51B, Alden Rigby's P-51D. He was with the 352nd Fighter Group. He was nominally the last ace of World War II because he had his fifth victory confirmed in, I think, 2000. And Maury Magnuson, who was a P-47 pilot, and he was a POW. But the pilots, again, my artwork, it's nothing without the pilot signature. So these guys, they signed the print, and I have a few. It was used as a honor flight fundraiser, and I was very fortunate to play a part in this because it generated a gob of money for honor flight, which was really, really cool. And Dick Cole and Alden Rigby were kind of guests. I got to cart them around for a couple of days when they were in my hometown. And I'd like to give a print of my artwork of the B-25, the two P-51s, and the P-47 signed by the pilots to one of your listeners. And each one of these pilots is a legend in their own right and just quality human being. So I thought it would be really cool if maybe one of your listeners, this is going to sound shameless, but when you get one of my prints or anybody's artwork that is signed by the pilot, something mystical happens. It's not my work. It's theirs. You put a frame around it, put it on the wall. You're having a party over your house full of people and somebody walks over and they look and they go, wow, did that guy sign that? You go, yeah, the guy signed that. And they go, tell me about it. And you've got 30 minutes gone.
And Max, I asked John in the pre-show for this if he could send me the print so I could then distribute it to the winner. But he thought that I might keep it myself and put it on my wall. So he's taking care of those logistics.
Yeah, I'm sure that would happen. So here's what we'll do. We have a question. There were several questions floating around. I finally got one from David Vanderhoof, actually just about an hour ago. We'll ask this question. Here it is. David's question is, who was Bud Anderson's wingman and called him, quote, the best fighter pilot I ever saw? So if you know the answer to that, send an email to our email address, thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and put on there the subject so we can see it, John Mollison giveaway. Give us your answer. What we'll do is, how much time do we want to give folks to send this in? What do you think, Rob? How long do you think we should give folks?
Well, I don't know. I guess I was thinking till the next show, but I guess we should probably give them a week from the time that they hear this, don't you think?
That sounds good. So this episode will come out on February 10th. And so we'll run it for a week, let's say. So by Wednesday, February 17th, send an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. What we'll do is if we get more than one correct answer, we'll put all the correct answers in a hat and we'll randomly draw one to get the print.
And if we don't get any correct answers, then I get the print?
No, I get the print.
Oh, darn it.
No, what we'll do is if we get no correct answers, we'll take all the answers that we did get and we'll put all those in a hat and we'll draw one randomly. And then we'll send that winner to John. And I guess, John, then you'll send out the print?
Yeah, I'll mail it out.
Fantastic. So this will be a lot of fun. I have no idea what the answer is to that question. I'll give you the question again. Who was Bud Anderson's wingman and called him, quote, the best fighter pilot I ever saw? All right, so we'll do that. And again,
see,
John,
and I thought
so
Bud Anderson was the kid on Father Knows Best, but
it's not. I was going to say, this is actually a hard question because I tried to look it up and I couldn't find the answer to it. Oh. So, yeah.
That makes it good.
Yeah, this ought to be fun. Yeah. It's great. It's great print.
If we get no correct answers, then we'll auction it to the highest bidder. How's that?
Yeah.
All right. No, then it could fund my trip to Farnborough. So,
John, what's in your future? Anything new or interesting coming along?
We're working on producing two more Old Guys in Their Airplanes episodes this year, and I'm not going to tell you who they are. But we work on a sponsorship basis, so I don't want to make any promises that we can't deliver. But we're working on it looks pretty good that we'll be able to fund two more. And really the next story that I'm working on, which will be published on my blog, is there's two of them. One's the Marine fighter pilot from Guadalcanal. He flew the Wildcat. I think that'll be an incredible little story for people to read. And also interviewing a new POW from Vietnam. And he was a F-105 pilot. So I'm always writing. I'm always drawing. Always. If you look at if you were in my studio and you were to see how many projects there are going at any given time, it's crazy. I've probably got seven airplanes I'm working on right now.
That's great. And tell us all where we can find more about you online.
My website is johnmollison.com. And the Old Guys in Their Airplanes episode, you can go to oldguysintheirplanes.com. Or Google me. I'm all over the web. And that's pretty much easy as it gets. So.
All right. Very good. John, again, thanks for joining us on the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Oh, this has been tremendous. You guys do a cool thing. I've listened to your podcast. It's fun. And I'm proud to be a listener. So this is great. It's an honor to be on the show. This is kind of prestigious for me. So,
you're too kind. Thank you very much.
It was a lot of fun, John.
Now, we have one item. This comes from Vertical Mag. You can find it many other places. Former Sikorsky president Jeff Pino killed in plane crash. Now, Pino was president of Sikorsky Aircraft from 2006 to 2012. More recently, he was vice chairman of XTI Aircraft Company. Now, you'll recall we talked about XTI Aircraft. I don't remember how many episodes ago, but not too long ago. They're the ones developing the TriFan 600, that vertical takeoff and landing aircraft for the commercial market. Pino was killed, as well as another individual, on February 5th in the crash of Pino's P-51 Mustang in Arizona. So very sad.
Yeah, I've got an anecdote about that airplane. It's just a tragic thing, but that airplane was owned by a guy by the name of Mike Henningsen until, I think, 2014. And Mike lives in Iowa, and I was involved with the Commemorative Air Force squadron up in Sioux Falls here. And that P-51 came in, and my wife got a ride on it. It was a beautiful airplane. Mm. So, and it's really strange when you see one of these wonderful relics, and then you see that it's crashed. It's kind of a tragic thing because you get a connection every time you see one of these rare airplanes. Even if it's not yours, you get up close to it and you touch it and you feel like you own something of it, you know. So I was sad, and you hear about the man, obviously a great business leader, and you know he'd accomplished something. It was sad to see him die, and so I just. That story is just kind of hit close to home for me.
Yeah, of course, it's always it's tragic when you have loss of life. It's tragic when you have loss of a historic aircraft. Together, it's worse. And when you do develop a connection, some way, it just kind of cuts right to the heart. Very very sad.
But airplanes do that with people. Yes. I think it's a unique part of technology. I don't know if cars or riding lawnmowers or snowmobiles do that, or snowblowers, but airplanes do. People associate so much emotion with the moment, the machine, and the pilot. It's really a unique experience. And again, you know, tragic to read about the pilot and the crash of, you know, Big Beautiful Doll. I mean, I'll always remember that Big Beautiful Doll. It's, but at any rate, that was a downer to hear about.
Yep, for sure. All right, Rob, are we going to do the listener favorite airplane?
I wish that I could. However, I have to admit that my wife's broken limb took priority, and I didn't finish it. So let's just – I promise it'll be done next week.
All right, we have a listener recording. This came in from our friend Christopher Sims. You'll recall that he had some comments about the air charter situation, let's say, last time. He sent a very brief follow-up recording answering Max Trescott's points after we listened to him last week. So here's Christopher.
This is Christopher Sims from Melbourne, Australia, saying hello to the airplane geeks. Great to get this chance to do another podcast. Just to clarify what I believe is a valid point that Max Trescott raised about my idea of sharing a chartered aircraft and acceptable diversions. So I'm going to use a real-world example. You have a day of meetings planned in Sydney and you need to be there by 7 a.m. You charter an aircraft and because it's only yourself traveling, you proceed to list the balance of the seats on a charter share website devoted exclusively to this purpose. You list the price as $500 a seat, and sure, and as luck would have it, you get an offer. Your person sharing is actually starting, like you, at Essendon, to go up for meetings in Sydney. On the way back, you have a second offer because the return leg is sold separately. One of the offers that you get on the way back asks about the possibility of a diversion into Wagga. Now, Wagga, for those who don't know it, is a regional city and a reasonably large one. It is on the Sydney-Melbourne track, so you're virtually overflowing it. So that is the kind of acceptable diversion, where everybody is starting from the origination point. However, you may make one stop along the way. Another kind of acceptable diversion would be a situation where your aircraft that you choose to do the charter flight has the range to go up there non-stop, but for various reasons, you don't want to carry enough fuel to get you all the way back to Melbourne. So therefore, you plan a refueling stop halfway back. Once again, it would be completely acceptable to combine a refuel stop with, let's say, dropping off a passenger. This is Christopher Sims from Melbourne, Australia, signing off.
Thanks, Christopher. It's kind of about the efficiency or the efficient use of seats on an aircraft.
Yeah, why not? I mean, I think we probably all agree that aircraft are often underutilized, so anything that could increase utilization is a good thing.
Yeah, then share the savings.
It just sounds a little complicated.
You think it's complicated? Yeah, but
Well, I don't mean in the sense of what they're actually doing, but the logistics of bringing all those moving pieces together, I think. Passenger here, passenger there. We need a stop here. Maybe it's not a big deal. I don't know. It just, and Christopher, thank you for the great emails you've been sending. I've been a little lax at getting back to you. Christopher and I have been chatting on the side. But it is an interesting aspect because sharing of anything here in the States hasn't worked out too well. On the non-commercial side. And I think we talked about that a month or so ago. But on the charter side, it is interesting. I just would want to see which operator would say, sure, I'll pull all these pieces together for the same price because it means more work for the dispatcher.
Hmm. All right. Yeah, and doesn't the person chartering the aircraft have to agree to that diversion or the extra passengers?
Absolutely. And that's going to cost money because you have to do another takeoff, and that's going to burn more gas.
So that would change the fare. And I'm Christopher, I'm not saying it wouldn't work. I'm just trying to figure out how it would work is what I'm thinking.
Well, and it would burn a lot more gas. You know, I think about a normal piston plane. Yeah, it doesn't burn that much, you know, climbing up. But wow, you know, jet aircraft burn a phenomenal amount of fuel at low altitude. So you want to stay at high altitude as long as possible. And if you're, you know, making two takeoffs, boy, then you've got a huge penalty in fuel.
Interesting. Yeah, it sounds like something that, yeah, it can be figured out, but you've got to consider all of these kinds of factors and, you know, think it all the way through. I'm not saying Christopher hasn't, but I mean, to work through the economics of it. Maybe you're right, Rob, is more than a simple exercise. All right. We also heard from Kent. He sent a link to an article on CNN, Why the Sun is Setting on the Boeing 747. Kent writes and says, I recently run into this article, been wondering about the future of the 747 and other four-engine jets, especially now that the price of oil has been and still is going down. I know the 777 and the A350 are much more efficient, but seeing the prices going down, would this mean delay in the retirement of the 747s? So it's an interesting question. Obviously, airlines are looking at the operating costs of the aircraft they have, looking at the operating costs of aircraft they could have, and whether or not they purchase them or lease them. And it's, you know, we're talking about, you know, the complexity of calculating the economics. This is another tough one. Generally, a two-engine airplane is more efficient than a four-engine airplane. You know, when the day's gone by, you like four engines or then later three engines because the reliability of the engines wasn't what we see these days. Unless you have a very large plane like the A380, which, you know, there's no way you're going to make a A380 size aircraft a twin with two engines. The economics favor a twin, but, you know, the price of fuel keeps going down and that kind of upsets that economic apple cart, as it were.
You know, there was an interesting editorial in aviationweek.com a couple of weeks ago about the A380 and the 747 and the fact that the fuel prices had still dropped. And of course, everybody that's involved in the industry kind of knows that Airbus has not made any money on the A380. And a lot of people say they never will. But the editorial essentially said it wasn't all just about making money. It was about changing the marketplace and that the A380 was something that precipitated the death of the 747 and what basically caused Boeing to build the 747-8, which has not been a success either. Hmm. And because if you look at the way the hubs in the Middle East have grown around the A380 and parts of Asia, and also the fact that it has changed the way the service element of the airlines has been implemented. You look at the top-notch service on Singapore and Emirates and big carriers like that flying A380s, and it's something the Americans can't even duplicate because they don't have anything that will compete with it.
You know, we were talking a lot last year, I think, about how there hadn't been any new sales on the A380. I did see a couple of weeks ago that they did sell three more. It was ANA, All Nippon Airways, bought three of them for Tokyo to Hawaii service. So they're getting a few more sales.
Yeah, small numbers. Of course, it's an expensive plane.
Yeah, and I see that being configured, 90% economy and packing them in, and they'll just move an awful lot of bodies for that distance.
Yeah, on that route, yeah, I would.
Yep.
Yeah, I would.
So, go ahead, Max. Three A380s. How much is that going to be at list?
About $1.5 billion.
Pretty close. Yeah, $1.28 billion.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But they were doing the same thing with the 74. I mean, packing them in mostly in economy, and I saw some. Who was it? Was it somebody that was going to do a 777 with 9 or 10 across, or was that an A350? They were going to do with 9 or 10 across.
Yeah, we've seen some, 9 across. Yeah.
Proposals. That's always the game. Yeah. Cram as many bodies in there and, you know, just, you know, And then the guys that get the perks, like Brian, when they go places.
Not as often as I'd like, yeah. That's for sure. No, but I definitely see the death of the international hub and spoke system really contributing to the demise of the 747 and the A380. And outside of the ultra long haul flights, like having Dubai in the center and them really continuing that trend, outside of there, I just don't see these aircraft lasting very long. And just like the death of the piano bar in the 747, I think just the entire aircraft's going to go.
Yeah, I think we'd all prefer the nonstops. I'm going to DC next month, and you know, probably pay double just to get a nonstop flight.
Yeah.
Kent also asked if we thought the steady decline in oil prices would immediately mean lower airfares.
Nope.
I think no.
Guarantee you that.
Yeah, I think the airline industry is very cyclic. We've mentioned that before. And so even though they're enjoying gigantic profits right now, largely because of, the yields are really high. They've managed to keep the yields high, but the fuel prices have really plummeted. We don't know if that's a short-term phenomenon or a long-term trend. And the airlines are not going to make multi-million, billion-dollar decisions on aircraft acquisitions based on short-term oil price movements. But they really like the profits they're getting now, that's for sure. Doug wrote us and said, just listened to episode 387, thought I'd pass along this link regarding helicopter flying that I stumbled across a while back. And this is called Oregon Christmas Tree Harvest with Helicopter, Amazing Pilot. It's a YouTube video. It was uploaded in 2011 on Christmas Day, as it turns out. And we'll put a link to this in the show notes. This is another one of those kind of amazing things, at least I think so, that's worth watching. It's really short, but it's about Christmas tree harvesting at this farm. And this guy is flying this helicopter who is picking up, it looks like bundles of Christmas trees with this cable underneath his helicopter and swinging them over to some awaiting trucks to be loaded up. And this guy is moving Christmas trees at a speed that I just find awfully amazing.
Well, and the timing of the swing of the cable.
Yeah, that's really cool.
The load. I mean, that's just fascinating. I just wonder how long he had to practice before he got that good.
Yeah, because he doesn't like fly over the Christmas trees, drop the cable, pick them up, you know, go up vertically, go over to the trucks, drop down horizontally. Like you say, Brian, he's using the swing from the momentum of the trees on the cable to place them into these trucks. And yeah, that looks, maybe I'm easily, impressed. by helicopter pilots, but this thing I thought was pretty impressive. Philip wrote in and said, "Hi guys, love your podcast. Thought Max F would be interested in this article." This is from WNPR. Pratt & Whitney's moving assembly takes jet engines back to the future. This raises an interesting, well, what the story is about is that Pratt & Whitney's Middletown, Connecticut Engine Center has a monumental task ahead of it, which is to suddenly increase dramatically the volume of engines assembled there. This is because of the geared turbofan engine and its various different flavors. Literally, orders of magnitude increase in production rate, which is something that this affects all suppliers. You know, we talk about the backlog, the thousands and thousands of airplanes in the Boeing and Airbus backlog. But, you know, that means a huge ramp up in engines, in component suppliers. They all have to, you know, step up this volume. I think, as I said to Philip or to Phil, it's one thing to design something new and fantastic. It's another thing to be able to manufacture it cost effectively, but being able to deliver it at these really huge production rates, that's a big problem too. And if you can't do that, then all the rest of that stuff doesn't really matter. So interesting article.
And Max, do you know, are they doing tours at either the Pratt & Whitney facility or the Sikorsky facility there in Connecticut?
I can't talk to Sikorsky. At Pratt, generally not of the Middletown, Connecticut assembly floor. That's pretty restricted for lots of different reasons. But, I mean, you can always ask. One option that is kind of interesting is the Customer Training Center in East Hartford. Sometimes you can get yourself into a tour of the Customer Training Center, which has lots of engines and things in there that you can see.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Tim wrote in, said, saw the this link, thought it looked interesting, perhaps a topic for discussions. This is EasyJet's fuel-saving aircraft produces water passengers can drink. Now, when I saw that headline, immediately I thought, fuel cells. This has got to be about hydrogen fuel cells. And it is. According to this BBC article, EasyJet plans to use a hydrogen fuel cell to use it to provide power when taxiing on the ground. If you're unfamiliar with fuel cells, what happens is hydrogen is the fuel, and it's passed through a proton something or other membrane. I can't think of it right now. And it produces electricity. It produces power. And the only byproduct is good old H2O, water. So I guess the idea is they would enjoy a fuel savings by not taxiing around using the jet engines, instead using the power from the fuel cell. And as a little added benefit, you get water that you can give to the passengers.
Yeah, this goes back to what we were just talking about in terms of jets being very efficient at high altitudes and very inefficient on the ground. So they burn phenomenal amounts of fuel, when they're just taxing compared to, piston aircraft, which burn very, very little fuel when they're taxing.
Right, exactly. And one last item. This came from Francesco, and this is another video. This is amazing Malpensa Airport, incredible plane spotting. It's in. It's a 4K video. 3 minutes. It shows a lot of activity at the airport, but again, in like the super high definition, a lot of it's in slow motion video. Just fantastic. Rob, I think you took a look at this video and were kind of impressed by it.
Well, I was so impressed, not just with the quality of the shots, but the editing. And it was so clear that the photographer knew how to capture a story that I just watched it, and I watched it again, and I went, wow. And let's face it, when you watch something, you go, yeah, that was an interesting video. Okay, that was nice. But when you see something, you go, whoa. I mean, and really, so I would urge everybody to go watch this video. Only runs a couple minutes, as you said, but it is so impressive. It really is.
I really liked watching the landing gear work, and the tires hitting the runway, and just all the dynamics that goes on underneath the airplane. You know, the parts where you usually don't have a good view of that kind of action. I thought that was pretty fascinating.
In slow motion, it was great.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, I think that's going to bring this episode to a close. Want to thank you all for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, John Mollison. You can find him at johnmollison.com, and that's Mollison. Also, oldguysandtheirairplanes.com. Look for him there. The great work that he's doing. And don't forget to send in your submission, your answer to David's question. And you may just be the winner of that amazing print. All right. Well, let's tell folks where they can find us online. Brian Coleman, we'll start with you.
Oh, still I'm being not so social. So the best place to get a hold of me is at brian@airplanegeeks.com. I also wanted to just mention, I thought this was hysterical. You know, I've been making the plea for help the funding to get me to Farnborough.
Yes.
Well, one of our listeners actually wasn't able to make a direct financial contribution to airplanegeeks.com/Farnborough2016, but they had a partially used gift card that they got from Christmas or at the holiday season. Mm. And they sent that along to me. And I thought that was, you know, spectacular and just a really great way to help the funding of field reporting of airplane geeks in Farnborough. So
yeah, it's a cool idea.
Yeah, definitely really, really appreciate that. So if anyone else has any unused gift cards, send me an email. We could exchange mailing addresses and get them that way. Or again, go into the website would be wonderful. And I appreciate the support so much. Thank you.
Great. And Max Trescott, how about you?
Oh, I'm being very social. You can find me on Facebook.com. Just look for Max, M-A-X, Trescott, T-R-E-S-C-O-T-T. Same thing on Twitter. If you want to learn about flight instruction and what I'm doing teaching in the Cirrus and other aircraft, just go to sjflight.com. That's short for San Jose Flight.com, though most of my teaching is out of Palo Alto these days. And my books are available at g1000book.com.
All right. And Rob Mark, where do people find you online?
Well, they probably type in Jetwine somewhere and find us on the blog, on Twitter, on Facebook, also on the marks on the mark over at aviationpros.com. And I guess I'm really impressed with the clubs that Max teaches at out on the West Coast, because he and I were chatting last night about the clubs, and they have a million airplanes in their fleets out on the Palo Alto area. And wow, I wish I lived out there. So for those of you that do, and if you don't know how to fly, you are nuts.
And Rob, I don't want to mention to you, but I will just in passing, it was 75 degrees here today. So if you get tired of the Chicago weather, come on out.
Oh, dear. All right. Yeah. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter at Max Flight, also at LinkedIn, and on the UAVDigest.com with David Vanderhoof. And also on the PAX X podcast with Mary Kirby. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com, where you'll find links to all the social media places where we hang out, as well as how to contact us. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/387. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Good night. And keep the blue side up.
Or, yeah, we can't really say goodnight because in Australia it's morning. So I guess that's a bit rude, isn't it?
Yes, right. Just say goodbye, Rob.
So, goodbye.
Goodbye, Rob.
Goodbye, Rob.